Hello, and welcome to the High Reliability Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Martin, president of Gosselin Martin Associates. As always, the High Reliability Podcast is brought to you by the Career Hub. You can find more information about the Career Hub on our website, gosselin-associates.com. Thank you for tuning in. I appreciate that, and I welcome our guest for today, Jordan Smith. Jordan is the Administrative Director of Facility Operations for Advent Health in Zephyr Hills, Florida. Jordan has worked at Advent Health for the last 8 years. He currently leads the facilities team at their Dade City and Zephyr Hills campuses. In his role as Facility Director, Jordan is Chair of the Environment of Care. He oversees compliance of the Joint Commission's Environment of Care and Life Safety chapters. Additionally, he has operational oversight for maintenance and repairs, emergency management, EVS, security, biomedical equipment, and construction for the two hospital campuses. Jordan has his Certified Healthcare Facility Manager and Certified Healthcare Constructor certifications, and he has his bachelor's degree in healthcare management. Jordan is also the current district president for the Florida Healthcare Engineers Association District 3 Board, and he serves as the district's representative to the Florida Healthcare Engineer Association State Board. That's a mouthful. Jordan, welcome.
Peter, I'm happy to be with you. Thank you for the kind introduction.
Ah, my pleasure. I appreciate that. We Jordan was one of the responders to our survey that we conducted late last fall, last September, and I had spoken to Jordan, talked to Jordan relative to the article we released with those survey results. And he had some really interesting comments. And so I asked Jordan late last year if he'd appear on the podcast this year. And he kindly said he would. So I appreciate that, Jordan. Now we're into late February. How's the year starting off for you?
Healthcare is a busy business these days, especially in Florida. Lots of people moving to the state, and our healthcare demands seem to be growing every year.
You know, it's interesting. You bring that up. What's it been like just working down in Florida with those healthcare demands? And you're right. Obviously you see it because you live there, but I hear it, you know, with the folks that I work with on a candidate perspective, folks wanting to go south. What's kind of been the manifestation of all those people heading south, both, you know, working in healthcare facilities management and just living? How has that impacted, you know, your role? How has that impacted your organization over the last couple of years?
Yeah, so I live and work in a North Tampa Bay suburb, Zephyr Hills and Dade City, as you mentioned in the introduction. We used to be I don't want to say a sleepy little retirement community, but we used to be a large retirement community. Many of the snowbirds, as we affectionately call them, would come down during the winter months. They'd come down around Thanksgiving time, and they'd leave around Easter time. And so we would have our busy season where all of our hospitals would be full, and then we would taper off outside those times and run at less than full capacity. Now with the booming bust, we are full all year round. And then during those winter months when our friends from up north are in the area, we're predominantly over capacity.
Wow.
So it's been, you know, just over the last probably 5 or 6 years, it's really started to blow up, and we've really seen a difference in our census.
So I'm going to call you on something you just said. Are they really your friends from up north who come down?
No, I mean, it's great for the economy. It's great for the hospital. You know, it's what we do in Florida. So we're happy to have them. And and I know they're happy to be here too, getting out of the cold winter months.
Yeah, no, as I look out the window on February 21st, it is snowing. We haven't had a lot of it this winter, but it's snowing right now. And what is that like, you know, just relative to, you know, as you go about, not even work related, but, you know, as you go about doing what you're doing on the weekends, kind of your daily activities of living, have you noticed, are there just more people around? Is it busier? Are lines increasing? Have you felt that outside of work as well?
Yeah, unquestionably. We've lived in the same neighborhood for the last 10 years. And, you know, just two-lane highways are becoming four-lane highways. You know, every corner has a new apartment building on it. You know, we have new Just in the 10 years I've been here, we have a new outlet mall down the street from us. I mean, so it's, so it's growth is everywhere in Florida. You know, there's new neighborhoods, new homes. They're making these, you should look them up on the internet. They're making these man-made lakes. They're like swimming pools, you know, to lure residents into these new neighborhoods. So it's really, they're really getting creative with how they build homes, with how they build neighborhoods, you know, trying to lure the population to their neighborhood.
So the man-made lakes, that's interesting. I'm going to look that up. Don't those man-made lakes also attract like alligators and stuff? And what would be the lure of the man-made lake? You can't swim in them, can you?
Oh, no, they're literally like swimming pools. They have crystal clear water. People kayak on them. They sail on them, but they're swimming pool water. So I'm not sure if they're salt-based or chlorine-based or how that works exactly, but the animals don't want to swim in it.
No. As soon as you said the man-made lake, my I just went right to a gator. And are they big? The man-made lakes?
They're very big. They're several acres big. I mean, you can take mini sailboats out on them, and
oh, that's pretty
quite impressive.
Yeah, I'm gonna look that up. So now that I've tapped into Jordan for his real estate acumen and his living in Florida, let's just get back to business. So Jordan, you've got two facilities you're accountable for. How large are the facilities? What's your square footage and bed total?
Yeah, so our Zephyr Hills campus is my largest campus. It's just a little under 400,000 square feet, and we're licensed for 150 patients. And our Dade City campus is a little bit smaller. It's licensed for 120 patients, and it's just a little over 100,000 square feet.
How far are those two locations from each other?
7.2 miles.
you make it often, so you know exactly what that is, huh?
it sometimes ends up on my expense report.
How long does it take to go 7.2 miles?
It's 12 or 15 minutes. It's not very long.
Yeah. Sometimes I used to have a long commute. Now I have a short commute. I mean, it's like 10 minutes from, you know, the office to where we live. But it used to be when we were down in Mystic, you know, 70 to 80 minutes. And I kind of liked that long commute because it allowed you to decompress, especially if there's not a lot of traffic along it.
Yeah.
So that that 12 to 15 minutes doesn't allow you really to decompress as you go between campuses.
It's long enough for a couple phone calls, so it's I still take advantage of it.
Yeah, that's the reality of today. So what is, you know, in your role, you talked about how obviously it's never boring. What are some of the challenges that you're facing these days in your role?
Yeah, so some of, you know, we have challenges. Our facilities are aging. My Zephyr Hills Hospital was built in 1984. My Dade City Hospital was built in 1974. You know, and they've had various upgrades and renovations and additions over the years. But again, it's starting to become, you know, aging infrastructure and trying to stay on top of it. You know, one of our biggest pinch points is, you know, hospital margins are continuing to get pinched. Cost of everything goes up, from labor to drug prices to material costs, and CMS Medicare is not reimbursing anything more. So as those margins get tighter and tighter, you know, it's harder and harder to pluck dollars out of the CFO's office for roofs and generators and all those things that we need to keep the building up and running.
It's you talking about kind of the cost of everything. We had friends over this weekend, and one of my good friends, he has cancer, so he's, you know, hopefully going to defeat it. And he's going, you know, he's going through treatment now. And his wife was talking. She happened to look at one of his bills, and one of the meds that they gave him was $13,000. And she's like, she looked at it, and she's a finance person, and she's not a healthcare person. And she's like, in her mind, she's like, is that even possible? And she was just going to call they do have healthcare, they do have, you know, insurance, but she was just going to call to see if that is really the cost of that medication at $13,000. And, you know, it's funny, we got into talking about healthcare, and I was just saying how, you know, it's not one thing that's driving the chaos. It's just so many different factors that are creating, you know, the healthcare environment today, which obviously facilities feels the pinch, especially as you talk about infrastructure and, you know, aging buildings. There's just multiple challenges you have.
Well, yeah, there's one more to take it one step further, another layer of the onion, right? So we talked in the beginning about population growth. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of our hospital systems have a lot of pressure to expand. They're building offsite emergency rooms. They're building new hospitals. So all of those require capital. And so especially, you know, for us guys that are in the existing buildings that we need to take care of, and a lot of our capital is going to accommodate that population growth. It's really stretching us. And so it's an interesting element of the economy in healthcare of how do we keep our facilities up and ready for those patients, but how do we also grow into the communities that our patients are growing into as well.
I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago with Terrence Wright, your neighbors over at, you know, Moffitt Cancer Center.
Yeah.
Down there in Tampa. And Terrence Wright is the VP and he's a great guy. But we were talking about the they're building a new facility, but the challenge in just even getting people toward, you know, getting employees. Are you feeling a similar pinch?
Yeah. It's tough to find employees. It's tough to find skilled employees that have experience doing what we do, you know, from the trades. You know, we're looking at people that have worked, we're expanding our range of, you know, if you've worked in an apartment, maybe we can make this work. If you're, you know, an electrician or an HVAC guy and you don't have institutional or healthcare experience, like we traditionally look for, you know, we're looking a little bit further outside our core circle to say, hey, if you have the right intangibles, maybe we can train you on this, you know, on this healthcare setting to be a good and efficient worker.
Mm. And that was one of the reasons that I had asked Jordan to appear on the podcast back when I was reading some of his responses to the survey, because you don't, and you can speak to it, Jordan, but you arrived at healthcare from the trades, correct? And so your path is just a little bit different relative to some of our listeners. What trade did you work in prior to jumping into healthcare? And had you done hospital or healthcare work when you were in the trades?
Yeah, so I come from out of high school, I went to trade school. I went to a plumbing trade school and got into the plumbing trade. I was able to earn my journeyman's and master's license, and I started a plumbing mechanical business. And so we were doing some commercial work, doing just about everything, not a lot of healthcare. We never worked in hospitals, but we did build a lot of assisted living homes. We did work in a lot of doctor's office and dentist offices and some med gas work and so on and so forth. So there was a little bit of, so that's my background. And then because of my construction experience, it translated well. When we moved to Florida, I was able to get a job working in a hospital doing construction management for them. And I just fell in love, and I love the healthcare industry and knew this was the place for me.
Interesting. So where did you have your business? What state were you guys in?
Yeah, we lived in Nebraska at the time.
Okay. Excellent. And then you relocated to Florida, joined healthcare. Is it a path that you envisioned for yourself?
No, not in my wildest dreams. I had no idea that I would get into this. My wife's father is an administrator in a hospital, and when we relocated, he encouraged me to consider it. And the way he explained it is, you know, hospitals are like small towns. I mean, they do everything except cut hair, and even sometimes they do cut hair. So, you know, they needed a wide breadth of experience from every different kind of industry to help make the hospitals run. And so it's when I got in and saw it firsthand, you know, I knew that I could make this work.
Mm. How well, you know, you talked about hiring folks who maybe not, they don't have that non-traditional path. You mentioned departments and all, but how well did your trades experience, you know, running the business, plumbing, mechanical business, how well did that prepare you for the transition into healthcare?
Well, it's funny. I think, you know, there's a lot of my peers, a lot of my colleagues that I work with, maybe they've been in the healthcare industry their entire lives and never had to run a business, never really had to, they've had employees, but they've never had to worry about making payroll. Mm-hmm. They've never had to worry about making sure subcontractors are paid. And so, especially in my line of work, making sure that, you know, I've sat on the other side of the table when, you know, we're, when we've got subcontractors sitting at the table and they need to get paid. And I know what that's like, and I have an appreciation. Mm-hmm. I know what they're looking for and what they need. And so I can relate to them on a human level, and it helps me, do my job better, because, you know, it's easier to find those win-win scenarios.
Yeah, no, that's really a great, you know, a great point on that, you know, relating on the human level. I've, you know, we've talked about this before on the podcast, but relative to education, and, you know, so you come out of high school, you go right into the trade, you get your journeyman license, you got, you know, your licensing, you're in the field, you're running your own business. And I've often talked to, you know, we'll have clients and they want the degree, and we're not going down this path because I've talked about it enough, but you just kind of reinforce something. If you have somebody, they might not have their degree, and obviously you have it now, but if they've run a business and had to make payroll and done all of those things, that responsibility and that experience is invaluable. I mean, you've run your own business, and so maybe you don't have the degree, but, you know, you're a contractor making payroll and marketing and doing all of those things that it keeps to keep your business afloat.
Yeah, where's the next paycheck coming from? You know, when you're a business owner, where, you know, you've got to be looking several steps ahead. And so somebody that has that appreciation and that experience, you know, they don't get caught messing around with things that don't matter, right? I mean, they fundamentally know the things that matter, and they're going to focus and spend their time in those areas.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great point. So I never worked in the trades. I'd always been on the owner side, and you just, you know, gave a little insight into, you know, owning your own business. But what is something about working as a subcontractor that a person on the owner side might be surprised to know or might not be aware of?
Well, sometimes on the owner side, you know, again, it's going back to the making payroll and paying the bills, right? I mean, when, you know, the hospital is a big organization, and sometimes we don't do it intentionally, but, you know, we can be in a position where we're asking our vendor partners to be 30, 60, maybe some organizations 90 days before payment for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
And that just, to me, that you lose leverage with your partners.
Yes.
And it makes them less eager and hungry to come and get work done for you. You know, so if you can be a good partner and make it a point, you know, most people, I feel like in my position, most people can figure out how to work with the accounting system to get people paid quickly and on time. Our organization does a very good job of it. But again, sometimes things fall through the cracks. And when they do fall through the cracks, you just got to jump on it right away and make sure that things get picked up again. And that way, you know, your vendor partners are eager and happy. They know that you're in their corner. You know, they know that they're somebody that you want to continue to work with.
Hmm. Yeah. You know, you talk about 30, 60, 90. I've heard of some organizations, and maybe you have too, that they're 180 days out.
Yeah.
Six months. That's a long time, especially, you know, when you have a.
Well, and then some, I'm thankful not to work for an organization like this, but some even ask for discounts. Well, will you take 50 cents on the dollar? And it's, you know, that's just, how are you going to get somebody that's done a good job for you to come back and do a good job again, right? And it's, yeah, it just, that's not the, so being, you know, going back to your original question, being a small business owner, you know, you know what that's like. And so you have an appreciation, and it makes things easier to move the ball forward.
Did it take you a while, you know, when you transitioned away from owning your own business into, you know, and I know you will, and we'll get to it, you know, you started in construction, the project manager role, but just from did it take you a while to, like, decompress or change that mindset, change your mindset from, you know, a business owner who's looking for that next paycheck to now you're within a stable organization, you know, into healthcare where, you know, the approach is a little bit different and the way you go about things a little bit different. Did that take a while for you to take effect?
It did. It's a different pace, you know, in the trades, you know, you're humping it from job to job. And you've got to work hard, and you've got to move quick. And again, you're trying to get as much work done in a day as you can. And in the hospital industry, it took me a little bit of time to adjust. It's a different pace. And I'm not saying it's a bad pace, and I'm not saying it's wrong. I think that we could stand to use a little bit more urgency in the work that we do, but, you know, the hospital game is, you have to think further out. You know, you're using your brain more, There's a variety of difference. You know, you're not very narrow and focused. You're very broad and focused. And so being broad and focused, you have to take a couple of steps back, right? You have to make sure things are organized and planned out. And you're trying to see, you know, as far as you can in the future. So that's where the change of pace comes in. And there was an adjustment making that change of pace.
Do you miss working as a sub owning your own business?
Some days I do. Some days I miss the thrill of making a sale. That's fun. And I do miss that sometimes, but again, the pressures, I don't miss those. Every once in a while I think about it, but then I remember what it's like with the payroll and everything else. And I'm very thankful for the job that I have now.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And obviously you're using all those skills that you accumulated along the way. Just last thing on your prior business. How large were you guys?
Yeah, I had, I started with just myself, but there were a couple of businesses that went out of business. And so very quickly within a span of a year, I had about 23 employees. We were doing almost $2 million in annual sales. And, you know, this was 10 or 15 years ago. And so it was, and I was, you know, I was 23 at the time, and I look back on it, I probably had no idea what I was doing, but
sometimes that's the best way, right?
It is. Ignorance is bliss.
You're doing.
Just get out and do it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So you found your way into healthcare facilities management. When your father-in-law suggested that to you, to transition, had you heard about the existence of the career? Did you have to think about it? Did you have to be sold on it? Or were you like, you know what, I'm going to give it a shot?
Well, I knew that, my father-in-law was, you know, he was a CEO for several large hospitals. And, you know, he was, when we would come down to Florida and visit and, I would see the construction and the different work that he would oversee as a CEO from that level. And so I always knew that there was construction going on. I think this is going to go into the root of what we want to talk about today, but I always viewed myself as being a tradesperson playing a piece of the larger puzzle. And so I never thought that my small piece would be applicable to the larger puzzle of what they were putting together. It wasn't until he encouraged me to say, hey, you know, I think you're smart enough and I think you have the intangibles. I think you can do this. I got the job on my own. He didn't hand me anything. But you know, he encouraged me to apply, you know, like we talked about before, I had to take a step backwards, from being a business owner, of running people to being a project coordinator is how I got into the hospital, into the hospital construction world, to learn how to build things in a hospital environment, you know, all the intricacies from infection control protocols to, you know, the different, you know, building an OR, building a neonatal intensive care unit, building all of these different things that are specialty type builds that, you know, are different than a doctor's office or a school type situation. There was a lot to learn over several years.
Yeah, that was, you know, when you wrote that on the survey, you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting, you know, you wrote managed development. It's hard to get started in our industry without having someone take a step back in their career. So how hard is it to take a step back? Because as you know, right, I'm sure a lot of people don't want to take a step back. They always want to be moving forward. So is it difficult to take a step back? And what was your mindset as you took that step back? What did you tell yourself?
Yeah, it's not easy. I'm blessed. My wife has a great job and a great career. She's a CPA. And so we're a dual income household. And so I was able to afford to take a pay cut. And I probably took close to a 50% pay cut, to get into my role. But again, I was in a position where I could play the long game and I knew what I was working towards and had the encouragement of somebody around me that knew I could do it. And so that made it a little bit more, palatable. But still it's tough to see people making decisions and then you're not the decision maker. You're just the facilitator to make things happen. You want to be at the table making decisions and it's because you've been doing it for 10 years. But then you have to sit on your hands and kind of watch things play out because you really don't have the experience. You haven't seen the whole process through, at that early stage when you first get into healthcare.
So when you're in healthcare and you went in as a project coordinator or project manager on the construction side, correct?
Yeah.
So what are you thinking as you transition into health, you know, as you transitioned into healthcare? What were, and when I say, what are you thinking, just to clarify, like from a kind of the process standpoint, from what you saw relative to how construction's handled and project management, or was there something you recall from those days as kind of being an overwhelming eye opener for you?
You know, it really wasn't. I think the most surprising thing to me is how similar it was. There were things that we had to, you know, I had to learn, you know, but it was, you know, we're still dealing with contracts and we're still, you know, dealing with change orders and, you know, the hospitals are notorious for owner changes in scopes, right? And so we're trying to manage that. And it's all the same thing on either side of the table. How do you work through it? How do you keep the team engaged and communicate the process and what our thinking is and the reasons behind it and the why? And so maybe my role shifted a little bit as to, you know, I was trying to educate and get people up to speed and keep them up to speed. But still it's still the same table that you're sitting at.
I remember one of the big things for me was the amount of collaboration that had to occur, which was, I remember just having to say, okay, this is what you chose. So you got to do it. Was that for you, you know, coming from subcontractor where, like you said, you're running, right? You're going for that next paycheck, but now I'm assuming you're a collaborative organization just based on what you just said. Was the collaboration part of it eye opener for you, or how'd you handle that?
It was. I mean, you know, nurse managers are a different breed, and I mean that in a good way.
Sure. Yeah, a lot of people would absolutely agree with what you just said.
But they're highly incentivized and motivated to care for their patients and care for their teams, and they have a very difficult job and trying to keep those folks up to speed with a construction game that they may not understand or may have never played before. That definitely was a learning curve.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You think back to those, probably the AEC meetings, the engineer, the architect, engineer, construction meetings you probably had as a subcontractor, where you're sitting around that table with just folks who are building the building. It was always kind of jarring. The language that was used in a good way. You're all part of that same team, right? And you always have those disagreements. You're all going for that same thing, but the transition from those AEC meetings where it might just be construction folks to kind of those collaborative meetings where you're with your nurse managers and the folks in the hospital, it's definitely a transition that you have to make to be successful.
When, you know, when I was working in public schools, you know, they would have construction people from, you know, the public school in the room, but we never had the teacher in the room. Right. Exactly. So when you build in a hospital and they bring the teacher in the room, not only that, but you've got live patients, you know, on the other side of your construction barriers that you have to account for and keep safe. It's a whole different element.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. It is. So you made the transition out of the project management world into the facility management world. How did that transition occur, and was it difficult for you? You know, you'd been squarely in the construction side. Was that a difficult transition for you to make, or was it relatively seamless?
I wouldn't call it a difficult transition. I think that my organization did a good job of teaching me. There wasn't a formal education, but again, I was able to observe. I was able to participate in the facilities world and understand it. You know, when they had compliance inspections and participate in those, you know, participate in getting ready for compliance inspections. And so there was a lot of cross training and cross opportunities to get involved with the facilities world. And then what made it really easy was there was an opportunity for our Dade City campus. It was an acquisition for our organization, and we went in and it's not a lot, but we spent about $20 million renovating the campus. And so I was able to do both. I had an opportunity to go do both, oversee the construction part, but also oversee the facilities part. And both of those went very successfully for us. And so it was, I would call it a fairly easy transition for me.
Nice. Now you have a lot of oversight, or many areas of oversight, you know, where you are now: EVS, security, biomed, construction, emergency management, facilities. Obviously, is there an area that you tend to like more so than the other, or do you enjoy them all equally?
They're all different animals. You know, it's the construction and facilities, you know, I know how buildings work and I know how, you know, the construction process works. So that's kind of my wheelhouse. And I find as I continue to progress in this industry, they ask me to get further and further away from my wheelhouse, which is okay. So security and EVS, I'm learning how the EVS department functions. You know, over the Christmas holidays when things were slow, I was up shadowing with our EVS workers, helping them clean rooms and you know, just trying to understand, you know, what goes through, what is a day in their life like so that I can advocate for them, so that I can help them, I can represent their interests and help lead them to the best of my abilities. So it's really, so I enjoy all of it, and all of them are different challenges, and it keeps it fun. It makes the days go by fast, and it's a very rewarding career.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, just as I listen to you speak, it's almost like you just kind of hit these challenges, and you make it work. You have a very positive kind of outlook on things. Maybe that comes across just as I listen to you speak. Okay, this is my challenge. I'm going to deal with it and make the best of it, and we're going to make it work. Is that kind of your approach?
Yeah, it is. It's stay positive. You know, I have a, I laugh. I have a no drama policy. I mean, emotions can serve a purpose, but you know, especially I found in my line of work, or at least for me, it's the more that you can separate yourself and just approach it with logic, approach it with, you know, just one foot in front of the other. Hey, this is what we've got in front of us today. Let's tackle it and move on to the next thing. So it's, that's my approach, and it's worked very well for me.
So I like the no drama policy. I'm going to use that. And that's really
good. Doesn't always work.
That's what I was going to ask you. How do you implement the no drama policy? Is that a point that you tell staff, you reiterate in your team meetings? And I'm realizing it can't always work because at the end of the day, you're still dealing with people. How do you implement the no drama policy?
Well, it's more of I don't have signs on the office wall or anything like that.
No drama.
it's not so formal, but what I mean is, you know, I remember, I think back to, you know, when I was, when I recently took over being a facility manager, we had shift engineers and we were looking at the efficiencies of the shifts and coverage. Mm-hmm. And long story short is I had to change a handful of people in their schedules. There was one gentleman in particular that had always worked, you know, 7 to 3 Monday through Friday, and now he was going to need to pick up a weekend shift, and he was upset about it. We were having a group meeting about it, and outlining the reason why, and talking to the team, and gaining everybody's buy-in, and he chose that meeting setting to, you know, have a verbal disagreement with me, and you know, it's not engaging back. Right. So that's where the no drama comes in is I get it. This is emotional. This is, we, you know, and I encouraged him to, you know, we can talk about this after in more detail, but he wanted to continue on. And I finally asked him to step out of the meeting, but that's what it's like. The no drama is, hey, don't let things get unnecessarily escalated. You know, part of my role is emergency management. Right. So when we've got hurricanes coming to Florida, you know, and all eyes are on you to say, hey, you know, how are we going to respond to this? What's our plan? How are we going to execute? You know, getting worked up and getting into, you know, frazzled and, you know, those are counterintuitive to the objective at hand. Right. And so keeping your emotions in check and keeping cool, calm and collected is I've just summarized that as no drama. But that's the idea behind it, is just keeping your cool and by that everybody else around you will hopefully keep their cool as well.
Yeah. Yeah. How did the gentleman, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but when you asked the gentleman to go outside of that room, how did was he receptive to that? And did that kind of quell it?
Yeah, he was, he respected my instructions and he left the room and we were able to reconnect the next day and, you know, patch things up to some degree. You know, he still wasn't happy about working weekends, but,
people get into those schedules, and especially on the facility side, you know, 7 to 3, it's kind of like the gold standard for when you'd want to work.
Yeah.
It's a normal day. So yeah, it can be very, very impactful. How did a guy, you know, you just mentioned hurricanes. Are you from Nebraska originally?
I'm from the Midwest. I've lived a couple different places, Indiana, Minnesota, and then Nebraska.
So how did a Midwesterner approach the hurricane season?
You know, we've got tornadoes in the Midwest. It's no different. You don't get any warning for tornadoes. So, I mean, it's just one of those things where, again, you just work the problem. I was lucky. I had grandparents who lived in Florida. And so Florida wasn't completely native to me. I felt very familiar and comfortable with the state. And while I had never really lived through a hurricane until probably 2017, you know, I knew people that had and knew that life goes on and it wasn't anything to be super scared about. So, not too intimidating.
Well, see, this is what I mean when I just said, what was that 5 minutes ago? You get a problem, you deal with it, and you move forward. That approach is, I guess I'm not surprised by the answer. So you just, the preparation, I mean, you're prepared and you see what it brings to you.
And even if you're not, you fake it till you make it.
Oh,
sorry about that.
No, that's okay. That's okay. The timing of that was perfect. It was almost like we could have scripted it. Whoop. Hello?
I went on mute and now it won't let me off. Sorry.
Okay. No, I figured that. I figured that's what was going on. No worries at all. Don't worry, but we can work right through that. Not a big deal. So we talked a little bit about, we talked a little bit about on a prior call, you know, your perspective on the employee shortage, I think, is a little bit different in a good way. What's your perspective? And you alluded to it a little bit, but what's your perspective on hiring people from outside of healthcare? How do you go about hiring the trades employees? And as you're looking, you know, as you know, people are sometimes intimidated to bring people in if they don't have that hospital experience, but you've done so in the past. Can you tell us a little bit about your philosophy on hiring for the trades and how you go about ensuring that it's a successful transition?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So, you know, we've talked briefly in the past, but one of my priorities when I'm looking to hire a new person is I'm looking for attitude. I can teach skill sets to most degrees. But if you have the right attitude and you want to come in and have a willingness to learn, that's really what we're looking for. Experience is nice and it's a plus and it can be, you know, the difference between one candidate or another. But again, what I'm focused on and what I teach my leaders to focus on is attitude. Is this somebody that we can work with every day? Is this something that, you know, are they going to show up on time? Are they going to put effort in? Are they going to be respectful? Are they going to be a good teammate? Those are the things that we're looking for predominantly. Those are my priorities when we're, you know, not just with tradespeople, but with management as well. Just trying to get the right personality fit.
Has that approach worked for you?
I think overall it has. It's not every example is perfect. But I think overall it has. I told you before, I have a facility manager that works for me right now. She's a female. Females in our industry are not as plentiful as males. I hired her to be a project manager on the construction side. She has a degree in construction management, but never used it. I was introduced to her through a colleague of mine who thought that she would be a good personality fit. And so when I interviewed her, I knew she would be a good personality fit. She was actually working at a commercial car dealership selling commercial trucks to contractors. And I said, if you can sell commercial trucks to contractors, you can come work in the hospital and sell our construction projects to these nurse managers. You know, if you can sell to a big bad contractor, you can work with our nurse managers without skipping a beat.
That is really interesting. So selling commercial trucks into healthcare is not a transition that you often see. So how do you go about, because time is an issue, right? I mean, you don't have time, is your time is always valuable, but how do you go about ensuring that they get the skills, whether it's the person who's selling trucks or the person who's working in an apartment complex? How do you ensure that they're up to speed and get the knowledge that they need to be successful in their transition?
Well, again, the biggest, when I hired Lisa, the biggest need that I had at the time was communication. She needed to be boots on the ground. She needed to keep everybody up to speed with the different developments of the project, right? The different phases. And especially with when there was logistics involved with moving units from A to B or closing rooms or so on and so forth. Just being able to listen and communicate what our intentions were, but also, you know, having that two-way communication of, hey, what are your needs when this happens and what can we do to accommodate it and to bring it back? And so, you know, you just started that fundamental level of saying, hey, your first job is to be a communicator. You know, you're going to listen in the construction meetings. You're going to understand what our objectives are. You know, the nurse manager is going to be there and hear it, but they may not always understand or relate to the elements that are going to affect them. And so you're going to have to go back upstairs, meet with them and walk them through step by step of what we're going to be asking them to do. What life is going to be like when we start doing this work and understand what their needs are going to be as a result of that, so that we can make those accommodations we need to keep the hospital moving forward.
And Lisa's been able to do that successfully. I guess, you know, it's interesting. It's too bad she's not here. I would just love to hear, you know, that transition. Was that a hard sell for you? That one just intrigues me, because the reason is, I know that if I ever saw somebody on a resume, right? If we got a resume, the salesperson in the commercial truck, I'd be like, well, there's no way. But then the other side would be like, you know what? Resumes are just pieces of paper, which is why you talk to people, because everybody's kind of has that story behind them that makes them unique, and they may actually be that fit. As you said, do they have the right attitude?
I've always wondered, to your point, I've always wondered if I would have interviewed Lisa if I had just got her resume cold. Again, what I'm so thankful of, and where some of my greatest successes have been, and I'm sure everybody can relate to this, is getting those firsthand referrals from trusted colleagues or friends in the industry, right? That's why networking in our industry is so important, is you've got to reach out and you've got to meet people. And you've got to make those contacts and resources so that when you need something or you have a job available, you know, you can put it out to your network of friends and say, hey, do you know anybody that, you know, I should be talking to about this?
Do you find, Jordan, actually, that's an interesting point. Relative to your role as the district president, your work with Florida Healthcare Engineering Association, just in general, do you find it's more difficult to network these days? You know, in talking to folks who work for other engineering societies across the country, they feel that they're losing that kind of the face-to-face, the networking, only because the demands on you are so, there's so many, and finding time to do everything can be difficult. Have you guys been able to keep that networking alive, or are there challenges that you're facing to keep face-to-face, to keep the networking, to keep those informal relationships alive? Because as you said, they can be so beneficial to you. Is it difficult these days to do that?
It is difficult, and I appreciate the difficulties, but the way I look at it is, I'm not going to be able to do my job if I'm not out there networking. You know, I don't have all the answers. I'm not a mechanical engineer. I'm not an architect. I'm not, you know, I don't know how to service med gas pumps. You know, I mean, like, I don't know how to do all of these things that require partners in the hospital to get them done. And so I've got to get out and network and find people that can get it done. You know, one of the things that we've seen, especially since COVID, is there's much more jobs are people jump to other employers, right?
Yeah.
And so when a company's doing well for 5 years, taking care of, you know, whatever widget it is you have, and then that key person leaves, if you don't have a network of people to go and call and say, hey, this company isn't able to cut it anymore, their key employee left, and the people that are left behind aren't up to the task, you know, you kind of have to have a second and third rung to be able to call on and get things done. And so that's why I value the networking component so much. And again, when we talk about hiring employees, it's the same thing. And I tell all of my employees this, my job is to help you be successful. If you can be successful working somewhere else, I want to help you accomplish that. And I want to, you know, I have this attitude where, you know, I want to have the reputation for being able to grow people. To be able to do that, you've got to kind of have a pipeline of people coming in and you've got to network in order to be able to do that.
Right, right. Do you find, not do you find, but are there, what percentage, not even percent, but do you find that there are some among your staff who they're very happy in their role doing what they're doing? They don't necessarily want to grow, which isn't a bad thing, and I shouldn't put it as one. They're just content doing what they're doing, especially these days in healthcare facilities management. They don't want to maybe deal with the management part of it because they see what's going on. How would you define your staff? Is there a large majority of staff who are kind of content to do their job, do it well, and go home at the end of the day and not deal with the management stuff?
Well, I think there are. I think there's a large percentage. You know, I don't know if it's two-thirds or three-quarters.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a large percentage, especially of our tradespeople. You know, they keep the tools in their hand. I even have a supervisor that was previously a facility director, and he hated the emails and he hated the meetings and wasn't strong with the computer. And he said, you know what, just give me the tools back. And he's you know, the best supervisor I could ever hope for.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that because you mentioned two things, like the employee mobility, where folks are, you know, they're moving more frequently than they used to. And then that's the other one. Well, occasionally in our recruiting, you know, in the recruiting world, we do, I'm seeing more people who want to take that step back, going from maybe a director to a manager or a manager supervisor. And sometimes it's difficult to explain to an organization that there's nothing wrong with making that career transition that this person wants to make. A lot of, you know, people are doing that these days, and that's a lifestyle choice.
Well, and sometimes it's necessary. I mean, you know, the hospital that I'm working at today, that, you know, my predecessor probably should have kept the tools in his hand. You know, I mean, it's not a bad person. And it doesn't hurt to try, but it just didn't work out very well. Right.
Yeah. No, not for everybody. And I know that work-life balance is important to you. And how do you manage that for you personally? How do you manage the work-life balance, and how do you keep, you know, your priorities between your work life, your personal life, and keep everything in check and in balance? How do you do that?
I realize probably, I don't know, 3 or 4, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, that, you know, the hospital's going to be there. I mean, the hospital doesn't burn down. It doesn't, you know, vanish. It doesn't, you know, things will wait. You can push it off. There's always emergencies that come up. You know, there's, you know, the one-off elevator entrapment that, you know, happens on a Saturday afternoon when you're, you know, in the family with the car, or in the car with the family. And, you know, there's always those things that happen. Saturday I was with my son, we were out playing somewhere, and we had I'm sorry to get sidetracked on this, but we had a car drive through our wellness center. You know, so I mean, those crazy things just happen, and you get a phone call, and we drop it, and we go run. But on the flip side, you know, the things that can wait, I mean, they can wait. You know, I'm, you know, Friday comes, you know, it's the weekend, you know, it's the family time. I mean, and for the most part, when 5 o'clock comes, I mean, I've got a family and they need me too. So it's, you know, turn the computer off and head to my first job being the dad.
Yeah. No, let's go back to that wellness center. What happened with the person driving through it?
You know, I mentioned, you know, I live in a retirement community. So,
well, I was going to ask you that. I was going to ask if the person was older who went through that facility.
She was, and she, her foot slipped off the brake pedal onto the gas pedal, and she drove the hood of her car through our wall of our wellness center, right through the weight rack. Wow. Nobody was hurt. Everybody was safe and fine. But, you know, just 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Quite a scary experience.
Yeah. How long's the building closed for?
It was just closed. We got it boarded up for right now so we can use it, and then we'll get it patched up over the next week or two here.
Yeah, that's right. We had an incident up here. So our office is in Walpole, Mass, and probably 3 or 4 months ago, it was before Christmas. There's a mall up here called the South Shore Mall, and up on the second level, there's an Apple store, and an older person was parked on the second level of the mall, and was able, and you can find it if you were to Google it, I'm sure you'd find it, was able to drive her car into the mall. There were no bollards or anything like stopping the car from going in. She got into the mall up on the second level and drove to the Apple store. So imagine you're in a mall up on that second level and there's stores. And here's this person in a car driving to the Apple store and was able to get, nobody got hurt. It was, she went slowly and
it is.
Thank God nobody was hurt. And she got right there and was just kind of confused. And I'm sure they're putting like bollards or something in now just to prevent that. But I had never seen that before. Drove the car right into the Apple store up on the second level.
That's so crazy. It happens.
It does. Yeah, it does increasingly. And you know, you just hope that nobody gets hurt in that process. Going back to that work-life balance, Jordan, that you know, you mentioned, and just for our listeners, I'm speaking to Jordan Smith. He's the administrator, director of facility operations for Advent Health in Zephyr Hills. I was calling it Zephyrhills before. Jordan told me it was Zephyr Hills, so I kind of like Zephyrhills better, but it's Zephyr Hills, Florida. Jordan has accountability for two hospitals down in Zephyr Hills. Jordan, work-life balance is, I imagine that it's supported organizationally, and that allows you to maintain some of that. Is that accurate? How does the organization support that?
Yeah, without a doubt. It starts with the top down, you know, the tone that you set, and my leaders that, you know, I roll up to in my C-suite, you know, they very much demonstrate that work-life balance is important. I'm in one of the rotations for administrator on call, and, you know, our CEO specifically tells all of us that, hey, if you are working over the weekend and, you know, you have rounding responsibilities, and if you get calls and are in the hospital, you know, you better be taking a comp day the following week.
Yeah.
And she flat out says, you know, nobody told me to do that when I was coming up and I burned myself out and I don't want you guys, I need you guys. I don't want you guys getting burned out. I need you guys to, you know, see your family and take care of your home life so that you can be a more productive worker when I need you.
That's a great message to come from the top.
And so I have a responsibility to teach that to my team as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure it's a receptive message, right? I mean, nobody's going to complain.
Yeah, no, it is very receptive. And, you know, as we're competing for employees and employees have a choice and, you know, the mobility of the workforce, you know, those are the things that are going to win the day.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes it's those smaller things that you might not think about that are the key in getting people aboard and keeping them aboard. I mean, obviously that's an issue too. You know, through our conversation, you've talked a lot about staff and managing staff. I know that you're an advocate for the facility staff, for your staffs in general that you have. What are some of the ways that you advocate for staff, or how do you go about touting the work that your staff accomplishes? Because as we know, you know, in the facilities world, you don't often get credit for, and you're not in the job to get credit. You're probably in it for the mission and the patient care and everything that goes along with it. But how do you acknowledge the work your staff does and make sure that people know all the good work that staff does?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'm very proud. We've had several, and we've worked at this, and this, it takes a little bit of work. We've had several employees of the month. You know, we have a nomination process and HR facilitates it, and, you know, making sure that they are nominated for those awards and those good works are articulated in that process. And that's just one component of it. You know, the biggest thing that we're trying to accomplish right now is we have intense focus on rounding, making sure that you know, we're rounding with all of our employees at least once a month is the goal. Just 3 or 5 minutes to say, hey, how you doing? Get to know them. Give them an opportunity to, you know, give two-way feedback about what's working well and what isn't working well, so that they feel heard, that they have a voice. And then when you get those feedback, you know, one of the questions I ask is who needs to be recognized, who's doing good work. And so, you know, getting that organically, it doesn't matter so much what I see, what are the people, the boots on the ground seeing, who needs to be recognized, who's going above and beyond, and making sure to point those instances out. It's one of the things that I do to help with that recognition.
Yeah. I know we're coming up towards the end of the conversation, but just to ask you about the, you know, the rounding, the 3 to 5 minutes, kind of those informal communications that you have. Do you find that staff is receptive to that? Do you need to, or are they all kind of different? You know, some folks kind of stay in their shell, so you got to draw them out to engage them. How does staff receive that, those questions, that interaction with you?
If you haven't been doing rounding, and it's an uncommon thing for you to do, it can be awkward at first, and staff will be like, "What the heck is he doing? And why is he talking to me?" But if you do it over and over, and there's some repetition and some consistency with it, then it's just normal everyday stuff. Hey, and, you know, my boss is out rounding again. He asked me how I'm doing. My EVS team has switched the kind of mops, and the new mops are harder to push, you know? And so that's a silly example, but checking in with them to say, you know, hey, you know, especially it's a predominantly female workforce. And so, you know, upper body effort and strength, that's a big deal, right?
Sure.
And so checking in with them to see how is this new mop? Are you making it work? Is this something that we need to take a second look at, and evaluate more? So those are the types of things that come up and how we work through it.
Well, and I mean, you're using that mop so often. That's a huge thing for them, right? I mean, that's a key tool.
It's a very heavily used tool.
Yeah.
And that's a big monumental change.
Absolutely. So what, without giving away the deal, what's the status of the mop? Going to stay with it? Is it improving, or are you still in the evaluation phase?
We actually switched back.
You did?
There was a variety of reasons. It wasn't solely based on the effort, but that was a big contributing factor. If our teams liked the other mop, you know, it could have gone the other way, but you know, the teams didn't like the new mop, even though it might've saved us a penny or two. It wasn't worth the dissatisfaction and other things that came along with it.
Listen, you don't always have to hit a home run, right? Sometimes it's singles and doubles that are just as important. And the mop would be one of them. And I imagine your staff was pleased to go back to the original or the older one.
They are. We just made that switch last week, so I haven't got a lot of feedback on it yet, but I don't expect to have any dissatisfied staff on going back to the old one.
No drama, right?
That's right.
Well, Jordan Smith, I really appreciate your time this morning. I thank you for joining me on the High Reliability Podcast.
Peter, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. It's my honor to be on your podcast. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. So Jordan Smith, Administrative Director of Facility Operations for Advent Health in Zephyrhills, Florida, leading the facilities team at their Dade City and Zephyr Hills campus. Jordan, have a great day. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, you too.
I'm Peter Martin. Thank you for listening, as always, to the High Reliability Podcast, and we'll be back soon with another episode.